The Incomparable. Number 598. January 2022.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very special Incomparable. We're about to saddle up, ride off into the sunset. Or actually, I guess we're riding from the sunrise as we begin. As we sit here and we talk about one of the newest Netflix original films, The Harder They Fall, starring Idris Elba and Jonathan Majors. I am Cicero Holmes. You hear me a lot on The Incomparable. And I want to talk about this film because I think it's pretty great. And you can't ride out without a posse, right? So you need your posse members. And what do you need? You need the guy or the person who is the hothead with the heart of gold. And I brought my hothead with a heart of gold. His name is Nathan Halderman. Nathan, how you doing?
I'm the hothead with the heart of gold. I thought I was just the guy here to soak up all the bullets.
Right. Well, so you know what happens is that guy gets shot at the end, and it really becomes poignant. It becomes the poignant moment where the music swells. We had a couple of those, and you can't have a good posse if you don't have the brains man, the person who comes up with all of your great ideas. And anytime I need a great idea, I call this person up. He's my friend, contributor previously on The Incomparable, but kind of on the outskirts. But I brought in, you know, a special heavy hitter, my buddy Sharif Jackson of SharifJackson.com. Hey, Sharif, how you doing?
How you doing, man? If you take Sharif, you kind of mess the letters around, add some other letters, you get Cuffy.
There you go. You know? Look at that. So look at that.
I think I'm linked to this movie.
I like it. This movie is The Harder They Fall. It released sometime, I think, in October on Netflix, directed by James Samuel. I guess it's James Samuel, who is the little brother of Seal, the singer, which I don't know if you guys knew that or not, but
I did not.
Yeah. Seal is on the soundtrack. The soundtrack is great. Seal's on the soundtrack, as well as several songs, both written and performed by James Samuel on the soundtrack. So before we get into the nitty gritty of this movie, and before we let that spoiler horn, those klaxons go off, we'll talk about how we feel about this film. Sharif, I'll start with you. What did you think of this film?
I mean, it is one of my favorite films of the year. It kind of hit everything that I wanted after seeing the first trailer. As someone that's typically not into Westerns, I kind of had my suspicions that I might not, that while I love the actors, that I might not like the actual plot in the movie, but I think that they really delivered on that. And aside from some minor squabbles, I mean, it's not perfect. Really, really dug it.
Right on. Right on. Nathan, what did you think of this film?
Well, I love Westerns. I love revisionist Westerns. I love Westerns that show you know, things you don't typically see in what you think of as a Western. I loved Godless, the Netflix miniseries they put out a few years back. I liked this film a lot. It was just like a big bowl of comfort food, the tropiest of spaghetti Westerns. I loved the color of the set design. I loved the sense of humor. And it really surprised me because on one hand, I felt like it was more style than substance. But at the end, I'm sure we'll talk about it, they snuck a lot of substance in there. Like that last twist at the end is really interesting and well done. And I mean, the cast is phenomenal. So yeah, I really enjoyed this movie.
Yeah. Well, and you're not going to get a disagreement out of me. I thought this film was fantastic. There are not a lot of films on Netflix that after I've seen, even if I enjoy, that I'm looking forward to, or that I'll stop and say, hey, I'm going to watch that film again right away, right? Maybe I'll revisit it years later or something to that effect. There's just so much content, right? So I'm just like, all right, I got that in. Now it's on to the next. But I've enjoyed this film. I also love Westerns, and I've had a lot of fun with this one, and I keep having more fun with it the more I watch it. It's really, really great. Let's go ahead and light that spoiler horn right now. And we're about to spoil this film. If you're listening to this review, you've watched this film. If you're listening to this review and you haven't watched the film, you can pause it. You can pause the review and then watch the film and then go back in and watch it. If you need to know whether or not you should watch this film, if you like Westerns, this one's a little gory, but it's a fantastic Western, and you might learn something along the way. So let's get into it. The first things first. We're going to talk about the cast, but before we talk about the cast, let's talk about how the movie opens, right? And the movie opens like this. While the events of the story are fictional, these people existed. And that really set a tone for me. That really let me know that they meant business. And I think where it sat with me was that this film, while very, very stylized, and you can see a lot of different directorial influences and genre influences throughout the course of the film from a creative and direction standpoint. And there were, you know, some very, very funny moments. Even though that fiction existed, it also allowed us to understand that there was an element of nonfiction in this, in the same way that American Graffiti was a fictional event that actually happened, right? This film, to me, felt like they were able to successfully accomplish that, and left me feeling like maybe this story didn't happen, but a story like this definitely did happen. Did you guys get that same sense?
Well, I kind of wrestled with that because after the film, I wanted to find out everything I could. I knew Bass Reeves.
Right.
But I wanted to find out everything I could about all the real people. And when I did, I was almost disappointed in the film because the people, the real people behind the names that have been borrowed for this film, with the exception of Bass Reeves, who was just so awesome, they pretty much brought him into the story as himself,
right,
are even more interesting than the characters they play in the film. It's like they diminished these people to fit them into the roles that they wanted in the film. And I don't know how to feel about that. I like the film. I like the characters, but it almost seemed a disservice to the real people who were even more interesting than the versions that are portrayed in the film.
Sharif?
Yeah. I mean, once I figured out that, you know, the events were fictional, I mean, to me, that automatically, I know they're real, but I kind of like lose interest in trying to find out about the real folks, because I'm like, if they were all together in great stories, they would have just made it based on one of the stories, you know, like around these people. So,
sure.
So I kind of had the opposite reaction where like I said, all right, I know these are real people, but if they're creating a fictional story, that means that they're, for all intents and purposes, not real people, that the characters are basically made up. So like it actually kind of lessened my resolve to want to know more about them at the beginning, at least.
Right. Okay. So what I would say, Nathan, is at least for me, I understand exactly what you're saying. In my research about finding out about many of these characters that I didn't know existed beforehand, is that in hearing their stories, trying to put one story together that all where all of these people fit would have been a mess, right? Like, it just, it would have been, you know, there would have been a stage show and then someone would have been shot and, you know, like, it would have been, there would have been a lot of stuff going on. But the one thing that it did do was it made me excited about doing some homework. And it sounds like it did the exact same thing for you, Nathan, which is that, like, oh, I heard about these people. I heard that these people were real people. Let me go and investigate and discover who these people were. So I really appreciated that fact. So, and you know, and that way it kind of tricked me into learning. Awesome. You did it.
Yeah. And that is clever. And starting the movie with these people existed makes you want to, like, track down all the names and then be like, and see how they relate. Right. Like, Stagecoach Mary, Zazie Beetz's character, right, was like carrying the mail, you know, on her back with snowshoes through winter yeah, storms with right, a shotgun and two pistols at the right, age of 60.
Yeah. That's like, crazy. That's crazy.
Her, yeah, her birthday, when she retired, her birthday was like a school holiday in the town where she lived.
Yeah.
This lady was amazing. So, yeah, I do like that this movie made me want to get up. I'd heard about Bass Reeves from, you know, from Watchmen and learned all about him after that. But I did appreciate that this movie made me want to go and find out more about these people. And in that way, I guess it does them a service. It's just, there's a part of me who's like, I know Bill Pickett didn't die in a shootout. You know, I right, know he was a famous rodeo star.
Right. Right. And yeah. And from, you know, from that perspective, yeah, it really does kind of do a disservice. And I wonder if the interpretation, when I saw that these people existed, I didn't take it as literally as maybe some other people did. I saw it as saying, like, there were people of color in the West that thrived, that, you know, that had their own, that had some agency, in a way that seemed foreign to us in the present, even 10, 15 years ago, that we just didn't really kind of have a grasp of, an understanding of. And so I kind of saw it more existentially than, you know, than the literal characters, and you know, but discovering those literal characters were great. And characters they were. Let's kind of talk about the cast. Let's talk about who was the standouts in the cast for you, Nathan?
That's hard because there are so many amazing performances in this movie. I mean, Jonathan, I got to go with like a three-way tie between Jonathan Majors, Regina King, and of course Idris Elba,
right,
who are all just like devouring the screen every chance they get. Right. Majors, you know, I've seen him in three different things now. I've seen him in Lovecraft Country, I've seen him in Loki, and I've seen him in this. And what strikes me is he has like the good looks and the charisma of a leading man, but he has the ability to vanish inside a character of a great character actor. Yes. The performance he gives in Lovecraft Country is not the same performance as in Loki, is not the same performance here. You can see some commonalities between them, but I'm just so impressed by his ability to completely disappear inside a character and make really interesting choices. And then, I mean, Regina King, the monologue she gives while she is peeling an apple in one continuous slice. Oh, and I mean, Idris Elba, when you make your entrance being unlocked from a steel cage inside a train full of armed soldiers, you know, you've got a good part.
Right. And they, I loved what they did with his entrance was, when he comes out of the cage and he takes that first breath, they fisheye the lens as he's inhaling and exhaling. And it's a blink or you'll miss it moment. It's very subtle, but it is definitely there. And it's like he is breathing new life into the world, right? Like he is a free man and the world is about to feel what is coming. Sharif, what were your thoughts? Who were some of your favorite characters, some of your favorite actors?
I mean, I think it's kind of a, I don't want to say the easy answer for me at least, but I think Idris Elba is probably the best, one of the best villain actors that I've seen in a very long time. Like, he can just play those morally complicated, a hero in my own story, you know, but Machiavellian kind of characters. He's just excelled at that. And I think this is just another one where you're watching it and you're like, wait, do I root for Rufus? Right. You know, well, like, even though the first 5 minutes of the movie, they clearly, like, he, you know, obviously he has a beef with the dad, but he murders an innocent woman, you know, and brands this dude. So they're clearly like, yo, this dude, you know, is bad. But then you're like, wait, but he founded this town and there's a lot of black folk there thriving. And he has like a woman in his crew at the time where there weren't a lot of women. Like, I mean, I don't know. Like, he to me completely ate up every scene he was in. I guess a honorary second to me would be Regina King. You know, I've been obsessed with her for a long time, just because, you know, she's just one of those black women that, you know, since the Boys in the Hood days, right, Poetic Justice days, like, she's been like really, really dope, you know. But man, I would say Rufus is definitely my favorite character, but she was the character I would not want to mess with.
Right.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, she's the scariest person in this entire movie.
Oh yeah. My God. Like, I wouldn't even say, like, I don't know. I kind of want to say pathological, but I feel like that's almost like not giving her the credit, because I feel like she's just like, this is how I got to be.
Right.
You know? And after, you know, really enjoying her performance in Watchmen, you know, and then seeing her in this, like, it's just doubled down to me that, you know, she's been able to transition into this new phase in her career where she can be these like super dope I would call her like an anti-hero, I guess. You know, so yeah, those are my top two, I'd say. I mean, I loved everyone though. I don't think anyone kind of missed a beat, but like, those are like the ones that struck me the most.
I can't disagree with you guys. Well, you know, when I grow up, I want to be Regina King playing Trudy Smith. That entrance, her intro, in fact, all of the character intros, especially the villains, were significant.
Oh, yeah.
Right. They were significant. So you get Trudy Smith, in a nod to the Spike Lee film Malcolm X, with the black glove pointing at the train to tell everybody to go. As you know, this is the homage, and the imagery that it's trying to convey is that it's too much woman, it's too much power for one woman to hold, as she takes the posse down to the train and then sits on her horse in front of this speeding train, daring the conductor, the engineer, to hit her. It's incredible. And another ode to Regina King and just what a great actor she is. I don't know if at any point they really made mention of this, but Trudy Smith is from Louisiana, whether it's Baton Rouge or New Orleans, I'm not sure, but she definitely, or Mississippi, like, she definitely had a bayou, like, Creole twang to her accent. And, you know, like, that's an affectation that Regina King added, that just added just that much more flavor and intimidation to who Trudy Smith was. But for me, one of the stars was definitely Lakeith Stanfield. His portrayal of Cherokee Bill was despicable, right? Like, so Idris was a villain, but again, he was the hero of his story. And Trudy Smith was definitely the hero of her story and was definitely a villain, and somewhat ruthless, or somewhat very ruthless, in the way she did things. But Lakeith Stanfield, like Cherokee Bill, he's kicking puppies, right? Like that's just who he is. He's just a downright dirty, despicable individual, but he carried himself with a level of elegance, I guess, or eloquence, at least when he sat and he spoke with people. And but like his introduction, I'm not a violent man, but I'm in the company of very violent people. And then, you know, and then he faces off with the guy, they're going to fight. And he knows exactly what he's going to do to this guy before he does it. And he just does it. And then he just gets more and more unlikable as the film goes on. And, you know, and every time Lakeith opened his mouth to have Cherokee say something, you just wanted him to keep it shut. just a fantastic performance.
Is Lakeith Stanfield getting typecast between this and Judas and the Black Messiah as like sad-eyed weasels who are going to stab you in the back at the first opportunity?
You know, I don't know. Like, so the thing about Lakeith, and you know, I think Hollywood's in really great shape with guys like Lakeith and Jonathan Majors coming up the ranks right now. Here's a guy again that I've seen in many different roles where I still know it's him. Like he doesn't necessarily get lost in the character in the same way that Jonathan Majors does. And you're spot on with that assessment, Nathan. But I almost feel like he manages to mold himself into the role as opposed to getting lost into the role. Like he just adds elements of himself into each of the roles that he plays. So it's still kind of familiar, but they're like just different enough where I don't feel like he can ever be typecast because it, like, you know, the role that he plays on Atlanta is completely different from these, but also the same. The role that he had in Sorry to Bother You, which if you guys haven't seen that film,
I've really seen it.
Yeah. That's right.
Amazing.
Right. Like, sure. Again, you know, similar-esque, but completely different at the same time. And I just really love the way that he brings what he brings to a role. What he brought to Cherokee Bill was really incredible. Cherokee Bill, by the way, also a real dude who killed 8 people and was hanged by the time he was 20. So also a really despicable person. So really, really well done. Another guy that I really loved in this film was Dion Cole playing Wiley Esko. Right, Dion Cole is a comedian. Many people, if you've watched Blackish, many people know him from his role on Blackish. Just incredibly, incredibly funny guy. But here he was saying comedy with a straight face in this film. And I really loved that he wasn't like a main character, but his role was pivotal. And I really appreciated that about his role. I thought it was dope to see someone who normally is just that guy have a chance to like chew up some scenery and have, you know, important stuff to do and say in the film.
Yeah, you got this really interesting push-pull with so many different characters in the film, like Rufus Buck. The first scene where he's on the train, it's been made clear, the film's made clear, these are the bad guys. So they could completely get away with having Buck and his gang completely wipe out the soldiers on the train, and you'd be on board with it. You're like, they're the bad guys. But they take the time to show that, like, Buck has been formally pardoned and released from prison with the express purpose of taking down this whole train car full of corrupt soldiers who massacred an entire town and stole money from the government. So the film is simultaneously saying, in the same scene, this is a bad and dangerous man. He is the bad guy. And also, this man is morally in the right.
Right.
And Wiley-esco, you know, he starts off as like, you know, a villain, a scary, dangerous guy. Then that's immediately undercut. And then he becomes more and more and more sympathetic as the film goes on. And Cherokee Bill, you know, you start out thinking he's like a cool, honorable guy, but what seems at first like class reveals itself to be cowardice. I really enjoyed the way this film wants to like play things off each other and try to make you feel two conflicting things at the same moment.
Well said. Well said.
Yeah. I want to bring it a little back to the Dion Cole thing that you mentioned. Actually, that was the one casting I did have I wouldn't say a problem with, but you know, given that all the rest of the casting was stellar,
right?
I just did not believe that this is someone that Rufus Buck would have worked with and would have trusted this town to. I don't know. I just didn't. I mean, maybe they just didn't develop it enough. Maybe they could have done a flashback to show that. But after seeing him, I was just like, Rufus wouldn't have trusted this guy. Like,
he's got gold teeth. Right.
Yeah. Like he just seems like a swindler. Like, he seems like someone that would have done exactly what he did.
Right.
And for somebody that was like, I want to build this dope town. Like, I feel like, I don't know. I just didn't feel that. And like, I don't know if that's because of what Dion brought to the role or because maybe just the way that that relationship was developed through the writing itself. But yeah, I just didn't get that feeling from that.
So we meet many gangs in this film. We originally meet Rufus Buck's gang, it seems like their sole purpose, or at least one of their sole purposes, was to help Rufus find and track down Nat Love's dad, who we later learn, of course, is actually Nat Buck's dad. Rufus Buck's
Papa was a Rolling Stone.
Right. Rufus Buck's dad, who has reformed his life and started a new one by played by Michael Beach, who's, you know, is a famous, he's one of those that guy actors that we know from a lot of different things. And we learn then that Rufus has a vindictive side, but it's also like justified in the way that he is doing things. And there is a level of compassion there. But so we meet Rufus Buck's gang. We then meet Nat Love's gang, which filled with Jim Beckworth and Bill Pickett. And then, of course, Stagecoach Mary. But we also meet the Crimson Hood gang. And the only person of note from the Crimson Hood gang is Damon Wayans Jr., which also was a funny thing to me to see someone who's been on all of these different sitcoms be in an action movie and have the role that he had, along with what they did with like yellowing of his teeth and all that other stuff. I thought his performance was really great as well.
Yeah, he's always just so entertaining to watch, and it was fun to see him take his comedic instincts to this kind of dramatic and villainous role, because, you know, he's still fun to watch, but, you know, you're not always at ease in his presence. I have no cultural background for this. Maybe you guys know more about this than I do. Maybe you don't. I noticed the use of reggae on the soundtrack every time the Buck Gang is riding, or every time they want to like play under what the Buck Gang is doing. Right. Is there some cultural or historical significance to reggae? Is reggae like considered outlaw music? Why do you think James Samuel wanted to score those folks to that particular genre of music, especially when he brings in a lot of the more Morricone-esque traditional spaghetti Western music elsewhere in the film?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't know if if there was a reason other than like, hey, Barrington Levy's around. I really like his music, but I think that was a choice. I think everything that was done in this film was a choice. And I think you found the reason, that like, you know, like everybody's got to have their own theme. And it seemed like, you know, when the Buck Gang was out there, their theme was reggae music, was, you know, was at least, the Barrington, you know, one of the most famous Barrington Levy, like just kind of like ditties. It's like the elevator music of reggae songs.
I mean, I do think reggae has been criticized over the years. I think essentially they were trying to give them a theme, right? Like they were trying to, like, they couldn't give them the Imperial March, right? They had to give them their own theme. Even though if they would have a reggae version, if they would have a reggae version of the Imperial March, I might have been down.
Right.
You know, but I do think that, like, you know, like reggae has had a lot of criticism of like being like very like kind of violent and hateful and homophobic and overly sexual and that kind of stuff. So I don't know if they were going for this, but I could see them saying that like the sort of critical bad part, quote unquote bad parts of like a reggae is what we want to come in your mind when you see these folks. So like that's probably the only cultural thing I could probably connect to it, but like you would probably need to talk to someone with a Caribbean background. I could probably add some more flavor to it.
Yeah, so Nat Love's gang along the way, they find themselves in the company of Stagecoach Mary, a former member of their gang, at her establishment. She is becoming a mogul of sorts, infamous and famous all at the same time, and we meet her bouncer. The clean shaven and feminine featured Cuffy, yeah. the young man at the door, you know that Cuffy's not about no guff, right away, but is a polite and honorable person, and you know we get to see that Cuffy can handle herself. Or themselves right away with those brass knuckles. I love these characters. I think these characters are fantastic. I mean, this was so much fun to get to see these characters sit and play.
Yeah. I love Cuffy because like, regardless of the gender presentation, Cuffy's just not physically intimidating, right?
Right.
Like Cuffy is short. Cuffy is not like jacked, you know? So I think that people think they could run over Cuffy, like regardless if they think that if like it's a, you know, a young girl or like a young boy, but like Cuffy put in that work,
right?
You know? and like, you know that somebody, as like you said, kind of a mogul in the making, and like Stagecoach Mary is not going to have some punk at the door, you know?
Right.
So yeah, I really like that intro scene to Cuffy's like a character. I thought that was really, really cool.
Yeah. Danielle Deadwyler, who plays Cuffy, just does a tremendous job. And if I've seen her elsewhere, I didn't recognize her in this role. And the person she's based on is, again, fascinating.
Right.
Enlisted in the U.S. Army under the name William Cathay at age 22, joined the Buffalo Soldiers, the only woman who ever served in their ranks. I mean, holy cow. Just, right. Again, another person who's I actually thought they did justice to the real Cuffy with the character. And I love the comedy that she brings to the role,
yes.
The comedy of discomfort. Like when they put her in the red dress and like they're in the bank trying to rob it and she's like fumbling. It's such a great, funny, but also tense moment.
Yes.
And then she turns it around. Like she goes from being fumbling to being completely cool as a cucumber once that gun is in her hand.
Right. Right. Yeah. Now I'm back to being me. Now I'm Cuffy. Right. Before, you know, Cafe was standing in front of you, but now Cuffy's standing in front of you.
Jeez.
Yeah. So, Danielle Deadwyler was the, she played the grandmother of basically, I think, of Regina King's father or grandfather in Watchmen. She was like Will Reeves.
Wow.
Yeah, she was like Will Reeves' mother or something like that.
Oh, she was really good.
Yeah, in Watchmen. So, like, it's funny how all of these characters, you know, all of these actors have been in other things together, and, you know, and like how those streams cross often.
It's just one of those things, like, you don't want to burn bridges, and even if you have a minor role in something, you want to like do it to the best of your ability, because
you never know.
I'm sure, like, as you know, the directors were reading the roles and they were asking the big people like Jonathan and Idris and Regina who else they wanted. They were like, yo, I work with this really dope person, you know?
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to quickly shout out Eddie Gathegi as well. I remember seeing him in X-Men First Class and being like, this guy's a really interesting. Oh, and he's dead now. Right. Oh. So I'm always just pleased to see Eddie Gathegi turn up in stuff.
Yeah. 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 Eddie plays, Bill Pickett. Just a great role. He, like, I loved his performance. For some reason, every time I see him, I also see Aloe Black. I feel like Eddie Gathegi could play like a soul singer. Like, he could be, you know, I don't know, some soul singer in some movie at some point. Just like for me, for Jonathan Majors, I always feel like Jonathan Majors should always play in period pieces. I think he just looks so handsome, like, it in period clothing. It just fits him well when he's wearing like high-waisted slacks or something like that. Like, he moves like that stuff is natural to him. And, you know, I've seen him, most of the stuff that I've actually seen him in has been period stuff also, but he was also in The Five Bloods, also a Netflix film, Spike Lee directed Netflix film. And he was fantastic in that. And that was set in present day, but I just feel like, yeah, he just looked out of place in present day clothes. He needs to have some like suspenders and high waisted jeans or something like that all the time. I really dig his ability to play with those things. I dug the stylized aspect of this film where, you know, so it kind of opens after we get the heroic first revenge killing of Jesus Cortez, Jesus Cortez, yeah.
Scorpion guy.
Yes. And we, you know, we get The Harder They Fall, which is like the most Western of Western titles ever. But we also get this very kind of spaghetti Western, but also Tarantino-esque intro into yes. the movie, right? It was like perfectly imperfect. There's the music kind of skips, and, you know, this kind of this sense of the film reel, which is kind of like a Tarantino perfectly imperfect kind of ism. But I think Tarantino got a lot of that stuff from spaghetti Westerns as well.
Oh,
so
for
it was,
sure.
Yeah. So it was kind of like all of those things kind of, you know, married themselves together. I've really enjoyed how this film, from a creative standpoint, this film, you could see where it was borrowed, you know, or where it learned its tricks and how it innovated on those tricks.
I loved the production design. I mean, the richness of the colors, you don't see that in Westerns. They tend to be, you know, washed out and kind of monochrome and bleached by the sun. And so to see, especially in Rufus Buckstown, those incredible purples and blues and golds was really something. And then, of course, the White Town.
Right. Maystown.
I loved the White Town, because if you look closely, you will notice it's not just that they painted the entire town white for the joke.
Right.
It's that on the crates, like the crates that are being moved or unloaded at the warehouse. It's not like Hardtack or like, you know, Jerky. It's ridiculous fripperies. It's like eau de toilette. And just it's a little blink and you'll miss a detail, but I loved it much. And I loved the cheekiness of like the big bold title, Maysville. Right. And then like in parentheses, it's a white town.
Yeah, and just like everything about it, it was a very kind of like Whoville or just a wacky thing, because the sand is white, the buildings are white, the interiors are white, like everything is white except for well, the people are white, but their clothes aren't white, you know, like everything is white in that town.
Hey, it just felt like going to the Apple store to me.
Right.
And I liked how they took a place that in real life would have been like a place of danger for these characters, and they made it a ridiculous place where these characters could not have been safer.
I want to talk about a little bit about some of the influences that I think, you know, we saw from here. So, you know, obviously the Western influences come pouring out. It's a Western, but I think about this and in a different way than I think about the last Western that had a black protagonist or a black actor in it, and The Magnificent Seven. Like I thought that was good. But I don't know that it struck me in the same way that this film did, but like it was cool to be able to see someone that looked like me be portrayed in this genre that I really, really love. But there was a film back in the late 80s, early 90s, I think it was early 90s, called Posse, written and directed by,
Mario Van Peebles?
Mario Van Peebles. There you go. I was going to say Melvin, but that was his dad. His dad was in it. But like that was like the Western for black people in it. You know, it had all of these black people in it, and it was and Billy Baldwin. And it was great to sit and watch that. But that was ridiculous. And this film is ridiculous, but not in the same way. Like this is a level of ridiculousness that can be taken seriously in a way that I don't think Posse could be taken seriously.
Well, yeah, I mean the elements of the story and the character help to ground it. You've got the wild, dynamic visual style on one hand, and it's great and it's so much fun. And on the other hand, you have that like a black hole, that center of gravity in the final confrontation between Idris Elba and Jonathan Majors, where all of a sudden, you know, when I was going along thinking this is a fun film, I like it, I like how tropey it is, you know, it's not really deep, but I enjoy it. And then that last confrontation comes along and it hit me like a ton of bricks. And I think that works as a nice counterweight to keep the whole thing from like floating away. Mm-hmm.
Sharif, speaking of that twist, the twist, of course, being that in the final confrontation, Rufus Buck talks to Nat Love and explains to Nat what his whole mission was, what his purpose was, what happened, his perspective on that fateful day, the day that changed both of mm-hmm. their lives forever. And you know, Rufus reveals to Nat that they're half brothers, and that man that was killed, Nat's dad, was also Rufus's dad. But you know, Daddy Love, Father Love, was actually Father Buck, and Father Buck was a repugnant human being that turned Rufus into the man that he was. And this level of mercy by carving the cross onto his half-brother's head was a way of showing that he was in charge, and that, you know, this was the way that things were going to happen, and how life was going to go forward. Was this a thing that you saw coming, Sharif? Was this a twist that hit you, or was it something that you kind of M. Night Shyamalan, oh yeah, here we go, this is at the end, this is what it'll be?
No, I mean, the Western I've seen, there's not really twists, right? They're usually pretty straightforward revenge stories. I figure that this guy was working with Rufus back in the day. Maybe he tried to cheat him out of something, or like maybe he was somebody that was in the gang but tried to leave. I thought it was something like that, you know? So no, I was not expecting the family part of it. And that actually kind of complicated the situation for me, because I was like, well, I don't know. I was kind of like, either you go into this house at the beginning and kill everyone, or you just kill the dad, maybe, because he was the one that made the mistake, unless you feel like his wife like had something to do with it, or she like, you know, knew about what was going on. I just feel like I was kind of wondering. I was like, what is Idris's code?
Right.
You know? it just seemed like maybe he just had an emotional reaction. It was just like, I want to hurt you the way you hurt me, so I'm gonna shoot your wife first and then you know, kind of thing. I don't know. So no, I did not see it coming. But it did make me think about the character of Rufus Buck and like us, and like trying to figure out what his code was. Obviously, I guess like he's like, I don't want to kill children, but then to kind of set up this vengeance thing, I know that he was basically like, I'm gonna turn you into me, and that's gonna be the, you know, the biggest revenge, you know, was turning you into a killer, basically. But it just seemed like a weird rationale for somebody that I would assume wanted to live for a little longer and lead his gang and build Redwood and, you know, and do this kind of stuff. But I did love that scene. I mean, to me, that scene, again, man, Idris just is able to carry these roles where he's like able to explain the nuances of being a villain. Like, he just is able to effectively do it to where I was just completely pulled in. Like I remember actually leaning in towards the TV, like during that scene, like just like being totally enthralled. I mean, both of them did a fantastic job. I mean, like Majors did as well. I enjoyed that scene, and no, I did not see the family angle coming.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is, I did, I think I spent a lot of time sitting around trying to figure out how Rufus and Nat were connected and why Rufus, you know, at least initially, like you, Sharif, I thought, oh, you know, this guy was part of his gang. Nat's dad was part of his gang and they did something happened. And now he's coming to settle a debt, or, you know, there was a bounty or something like that. But then once I realized that probably wasn't the case. Then I started thinking about like, oh, you know, what is the dynamic? What could the dynamic be here? And then I realized like, oh, wait a minute. He hasn't killed Nat yet. And because he hasn't killed Nat yet, he must want him alive for some reason. And then I'm doing the calculations in my brain. And that was the thing that I stuck with. And then as I started to hear the story, I was like, oh yeah. There it is. And you know, sure enough. But again, like you said, Sharif, there aren't many, if any, Westerns with these types of twists. They're, you know, generally just revenge stories or stories of the posse going off and getting into misadventures. So, you know, it was refreshing to see that type of twist thrown into the film. And then we get the space, of course, after the heroic killing. Would you have killed Rufus?
Yeah, no, that's a tragedy on both sides,
right?
And that great haunting line afterward, is the devil dead? I don't know.
I don't know that I would have either had the strength or, you know, like, I don't know what I would have done in that particular instance. It just, it didn't feel good at the end, but I guess it's not supposed to.
Well, yeah, but that Idris was right though, right? He was like, I turned you into this person.
Right.
So I feel like it fit the character. Like that's my, like, it's probably not something he wanted to, he like would rationally think about doing, but I think, I mean, he sees this, he's thinking about his parents, he's thinking about that night, like, you know, I think his emotions got the best of him. And I think that for a lot of people in that situation, it's reasonable to think that your emotions can get the best of you, you know, like, I don't think it was like this 100% rational, I got to kill this person, like, before they kill me person. I think it's kind of like that, like, you kill my parents, and that's all that matters. You know what I mean?
My name is Inigo Montoya.
Yeah, exactly.
I was thinking, or Luke Skywalker at the end of Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, exactly. That, or like, you know, like Iron Man and Bucky, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, right. it's a very common thing.
Right.
In like a lot of these movies. Yes.
But it's still, it's still a tragedy.
We got to come up with new tropes. What we also had at the end was, you know, much back to Nathan's Star Wars reference. We had Darth Vader, flying in his TIE fighter at the end in the form of treacherous Trudy Smith, still alive, ready for the sequel. Do we think we'll get a sequel from this film?
I don't know. I hope so. I'd love to see more of this world. It's really entertaining. The characters are great. Regina King is amazing. Right. She could definitely, of all the characters in this movie, if you have to off Idris Elba in the first movie, she could carry the second movie easily as a villain on her own.
Yeah, I can see, I don't know if I would say a sequel, meaning everyone like reprising their roles. Well, like everyone that's alive. Right. I could see more of a focused spinoff. You know, like where it just focuses on maybe one or two of the characters, and maybe introduces like some like a new characters. I could see that for sure.
I want to see a series with Bass Reeves and his deputy Cuffy.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah, we haven't really talked about Delroy Lindo as Bass Reeves.
No, because not at all.
He's awesome. Bass right. Reeves is awesome. Delroy right. Lindo is awesome. It is just the union of two incredibly awesome souls. It's yeah. Those of you listening, if you've never read about Bass Reeves, Texas Monthly Magazine published a recent article about him. You can just search Texas Monthly Bass Reeves. It's an incredible account of the man's life and how a lot of the things that he went through cycle through history and continue today. But Bass Reeves was an incredible human being, and Delroy Lindo just really does him justice in a lot of fun ways.
Not so secretly, but secretly, Delroy Lindo is probably one of my favorite actors. I adore his, like, there's something that he brings. There's a certain level of gravitas that he brings to a role that makes me stand up and pay attention. Perfect casting of Bass Reeves as Delroy Lindo, or Delroy Lindo as Bass Reeves. Because the legend of Bass Reeves and real world accounts of Bass Reeves are legendary or mythological. But like the things that were happening in the film, this work of fiction that we talked about earlier, about what, you know, the fictional characters that versus the actual people and their representations. Bass Reeves was the one character in this film that was kind of like a one-to-one, like this could have legitimately been a thing that Bass Reeves had gone through. And the portrayal of Delroy Lindo in the fight scenes, in the, you know, in the off sections, just the kind of wisdom, the level of cool, the fact that you knew that his heart was pumping, but you never saw that on the outside, that you know, that he was always just calm and ready to go. was just, it was perfect. And you really believe that were we watching actual Bass Reeves, it would be the exact same. Just incredible.
Yeah, Delroy Lindo, in all of his performances, there's this element where you can look in his eyes and you can see the wheels turning in his character's head.
Yes.
And that works so well for Bass Reeves, a guy who has so much experience, has faced so much danger, that every time he goes into a situation, he is always calculating. He's always working the angles, planning his next move. It's really fantastic.
Incredible. Yeah, he's perfect at being a bit of a tortured soul, right? Because... Yes. Yes, he's the authority, but he's also like, well, like, you know, sometimes there's things that are higher than just who I need to arrest, you know, but like, he doesn't make any decision lightly. Like as you said, you can kind of feel the indecision, I would say, just the thoughtfulness, right? He's always thinking about what is the best thing in this situation. Like, what is the net benefit to the greatest amount of people in this situation? You know, and he's just perfect for those kind of roles. And he is literally perfect casting for that role.
Yeah,
I agree
with
that.
And ironically enough, Delroy Lindo and Jonathan Majors last work together in The Five Bloods, where Delroy Lindo played Jonathan Majors' dad. And there was a very similar type of dynamic in this film. The two of them are incredible actors. So you would, I think there would have been chemistry anyway, but their chemistry seemed natural. It seemed believable. Like at every single point, both of these guys and their performances and their chemistry, it just felt real. It just helped me to get lost in this film. Before we go, I would be remiss if I didn't talk about, we did talk about the use of reggae music, but let's talk about the soundtrack in this. Again, it was very, very stylized. I love the fact that there were moments where the actors performed in this film that's not a musical, but Stagecoach Mary's introduction, where she is singing in her saloon. But then there's also that moment before they ride off in the last, before the last showdown, where I forget who it was. I think Bill Pickett starts singing a song and the rest of the gang picks up, and then we're left with Nat singing the very last part of that. And us looking at Nat before we move off onto what could be, what we know to be someone's last day on Earth. I love the fact that James Samuel decided to add that stuff to it, but also to incorporate modern music, music that was evocative of the time, but also music that would get you to tap your foot or snap your fingers. It kind of reminded me of like Baz Luhrmann in that way.
Yeah, and that song is such a nifty bit of character building too. It foreshadows what's going to happen. It builds mood. It also shows you that these guys are a family. They know each other. They have this tradition that they embark on as like a bonding exercise. And it's just a really clever bit of shorthand. It does a lot of things at once. This film doesn't waste a single scene, a single moment. There's no scene in here that I can look at and say, well, that should have been cut out. It really does move swiftly and efficiently. And it always makes interesting choices, even when it's deliberately going for those familiar, comfortable tropes that you love.
I was a little worried going into this film that usually with movies with majority black casts, I feel like they try to shoehorn in a lot of hip hop that doesn't necessarily evoke the spirit of the movie. Like it's more about like, let's just get some hot artists, you know, and just have them just make some songs so that we can make the movie sell more. So, you know, being, you know, a 80s kid, I was a little worried that I guess a lot of the more modern rap style would be in this film. And that it would like take away from scenes, you know, like there'd be this really great Idris scene and then there would be like, you know,
low baby,
you know, like a low Western tumbleweed chody, you know, just mumbling his way through some songs. So I was a little worried about that, but I think they nailed it with the score, man. I think that all the songs didn't take away from the gravity of the scenes.
Right.
You know, in that it could have been where like it was more like, let's treat this like an album. Let's just throw stuff on there, you know.
Right.
But I feel like they were really measured in like what they chose to include. And I think that's part of what makes it a phenomenal movie.
So most of the songs are original songs for the film, and most of them were written by James Samuel. But you got people like Seal, like his big brother Seal, Lauryn Hill, CeeLo Green, Zazie Beetz actually performs one of the songs in film. Actually, performs a song that we saw her perform in the film. There was great care put into composing an entire film, from the writing, the directing, and even the soundtrack. I thought this film was fantastic. It to me is the best Western I've seen since Unforgiven. I really, really love this film, and not only do I would I recommend it to people that haven't normally been represented and are looking for Westerns to watch, but just fans of Westerns, I think, you know, as long as you can get the movie is gory, like that's a thing that you need to reconcile with, we would be remiss if we didn't say that. But outside of that, if you can get past the gore, it is just, I thought, a remarkable, probably again the best Western that I've seen since Unforgiven.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. Though I really did like. I think the last Western I really enjoyed a lot was True Grit.
Oh yeah, I haven't seen that. I need to watch that maybe.
Yeah, yeah. I think it came out like late 2000s or early 2010s. I forgot the exact year.
I think it was like 2012.
Well, like it was like a Coen Brothers film, and I thought it was phenomenal. But yeah, I mean, I think this film, like, I think as I am, even if you're not necessarily a fan of Westerns, I think, and you can get through the violence of it. It's just a great story. The performances just really gives everybody time to shine. And it doesn't feel like it's like a vehicle for one actor at the expense of others, you know. It feels like they really do give everyone time to shine, and I felt happy for everybody to be a part of this film, to like be part of like the mainstream kind of narrative, which is not something that we often see with movies with a predominantly black cast, especially in like genres that don't have that a lot, like Westerns, you know. So but I feel like that this is not like some niche film that, you know, you should only see if you enjoy seeing black people in films. Like, this is just a dope film that I think can be enjoyed by anyone as long as you can get through, as I said before, it like is violent, you know, and like all that stuff. But I think it's great, and I think it's worth anyone checking it out.
Yeah, I mean, between this and Godless, which is mostly about white people, but it does have a really interesting narrative thread about a community of former Buffalo soldiers that kind of intersect with the other storylines. And The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, Netflix has really done an interesting job of finding fresh perspectives on the Western. And yeah, what makes this film so interesting is, again, that push and pull. It's the tropiest of tropey Westerns, but it always tries to be fresh and new. It's a rousing, fun, big spectacle of an action movie that's a real crowd pleaser, but it also feels like somebody's personal statement, like James Samuel really poured his heart and soul into this movie. So yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, I think one thing that we learned is that Westerns are more than one thing, and that we can see realistic films in this genre that star people that typically aren't seen in this genre predominantly. And hopefully we'll see more of that coming, you know, in the future, not only from Netflix, but from, you know, from other people. And, you know, all good things must come to an end. It's time for us to ride. We got through High Noon. The sun is about to set and we need to get back to our hideout. So, I will say thank you to, my sure shot at gunman. He didn't have to eat up the bullets, Nathan Alderman. Thanks so much for joining.
My pleasure. Now let me see if I can just manage to stay on the horse.
All right. You know, that's a trick we all have to accomplish. And the brains of the operation, Sharif Jackson, thanks a lot for coming along.
No problem, man. This is a great movie. I'm going to watch it again.
There you go. Yippee-ki-yay, mother suckers. I am Cicero Holmes. Thanks so much for taking the chance to listen. We'll see you around now, you hear? Now get it.